Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Next on News One Now, tonight, the big night for President Barack Obama as he delivers his final State of the Union address. We are joined by senior advisors to the president, Valerie Jarrett, for a glimpse of what to expect. Also, is justice finally being served in the Eric Garner case? We will talk to his daughter about the latest development in his case. Charges dismissed. Bill Cosby's legal team looks to have all charges against the TV star thrown out in Pennsylvania. And what's up with the affluenza mom and son duo? One gets a slap on the wrist for murder, and now it looks like the mom is getting the same treatment. All that more coming up right now on News One Now. For the final time during his presidency, President Barack Obama will step before Congress to deliver the State of the Union address. It will be the final State of the Union address for President Obama. The White House says the address will be non-traditional. He will not be asking Congress for a long list of items. He's also expected to talk about a variety of issues, including his most recent move to bypass Congress by using executive authority to expand gun regulations. In his weekly address, the president hinted about what to expect during tonight's speech.
The point is, America can do anything. Even in times of great challenge and change, our future is entirely up to us. It's been on my mind while I'm writing my final State of the Union address. And on Tuesday, I'm going to talk about the choices we have to make to set this country firmly on an even better, brighter course for decades to come.
The White House also reached out to a variety of folks, inviting them personally to attend the State of the Union address.
Jenny?
Yes.
Hi, it's Jill Biden.
Hello, how are you?
Hello, Earl, it's Valerie Jarrett.
You know, he saw your story on Humans of New York, as have millions of Americans. And the president has been deeply moved by the journey that you've made from Syria to the United States.
Now, yesterday on the Tom Joyner Morning Show, I spoke with Valerie Jarrett, senior advisor to President Barack Obama, about tonight's speech.
It isn't going to be the traditional State of the Union speech where he just, you know, kind of goes through his accomplishments and then sets the agenda for next year. He's going to set the agenda for the future of our country and really describe his view about our future and how we compete in a global marketplace, how we keep America straight, not through isolation, but through building alliances and consensus. And I think you will leave hopefully feeling lifted up, but also feeling motivated to work hard.
All right, folks, let's discuss this with our panel. Steve Phillips, attorney and author of the book, Brown is the New White. Paris Denard, legislative director for the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. And David Swerlick, assistant editor for the Washington Post. Folks, final State of the Union address, it certainly is going to be a little different than what we've seen in the past. What do you expect? What should the president talk about tonight?
Well, Roland, I think it's a smart thing for the president not to try to list a lot of priorities that he wants to do legislatively. I think he is right to focus on the future and to inspire the country. And I hope that he will go back to the Senator Obama that we saw at the DNC and many of his earlier speeches running for president that inspired and brought the country together, because I think that's exactly what we need today. And when you look at this new Speaker of the House, I think you have someone in Paul Ryan who is willing to work with the president and pass some important things. And so as they look to the future, I hope that is what the president can highlight tonight.
Well, Roland, I agree with Paris on the issue of it's probably at this stage in his presidency not the way to go to do a long laundry list of policy or legislative priorities. And so focusing on a couple of key issues will make the most sense, and trying to sort of put a bow on all the things he's done over the last few years. That being said, I do think there are some things he really needs to hit. I think this is one of the president's last good opportunities to really explain to people that he's doing a fairly, in my view, narrow restructuring of rules related to to gun control, not doing a big change to the Second Amendment, just talking about the fact that they're going to reclassify who is a gun seller. I also think this is an opportunity for him to clean up some of what I think was very poor messaging the last month or so on ISIS, on national security. And so I think he has to take time to do that.
You know what? I think that, look, I mean, I get the whole deal in terms of this is your last hurrah, but I'm sorry. I think sort of like in sports, you know what? When there's still clock on the time, you keep playing. Okay, you don't sit here and sort of begin to reflect on what happened in the previous three quarters. No, you win the game. And I think the president should take the opportunity to say, look, this is my last year. Congress, y'all voted 62 times. I said this to Valerie Jarrett. I said, look, when the president vetoed the bill repealing the Affordable Care Act, I wouldn't have vetoed it last week. I would have vetoed that sucker tonight and turned around and handed it to Paul Ryan. 62 different times they voted when it came to the Affordable Care Act. And I'm sorry, at some point they still have to be challenged. I need y'all to get to work. I need you to get to work on jobs. I need you to get to work on the economy as opposed to keep doing these silly sort of votes.
Right, yeah. No, I think this is an opportunity to, this is the president, the most opposed president probably in the history of the country. Everything he's tried to do that he's been blocked every single step of the way. And so what he has an opportunity to do now is to both lay out all the places he was right and they were wrong, but also set the table and set the context for the 2016 election around, are we going to continue to move in the direction that he put forward in terms of trying to meet the needs of everybody, or are we going to move in the direction that the Republicans had of trying to block these measures every single step of the way?
And I think also that the challenge has to be there to talk to America to say, hey, y'all, we are changing as a nation.
Sure.
Okay, so this whole, and look, deal with it. He's not going to bring up Trump. He's not going to bring up what's happening on the Republican side. But you have to speak to that because you got folks running around here who frankly want to have throwback America. And I'm sorry, we're not going back there.
Right. Yeah, Roland, I think you make a really good point about the fact that there's a year left in his presidency. Don't waste it. Don't run out the clock. Go ahead and play out the last quarter. Totally agree. But I do think, though, that he has in the past focused in various States of the Union address or State of the Union addresses on infrastructure 1 year. That didn't go very far. 1 year he focused on health care. That didn't go very far. One of the most moving moments I can remember, I think it was 2013, when he brought up Hadia Pendleton, the Chicago teenager. He said she was a majorette. She, you know, she liked lip gloss. She was a great high school student. I mean, that, you know, it almost brought a tear to my eye. But, you know, where have we gone since then? People like this president as a person. They like to see him. They like to hear him speak. I'm not so sure, though, that he's been able to push an agenda from these speeches.
Right? Yeah, but again, though, I still believe the challenge is there. The job numbers just came out in terms of the more than 200,000 plus jobs that were added. And you look at the unemployment rate being the lowest it's been in really the last 7 or 8 years. The challenge still has to be there. I still believe with Speaker Paul Ryan, and I believe again saying, okay, y'all say you are about America, making America strong. This is where again where we agree. Let's have some action. Enough with a do nothing Congress.
Well, you know, it was President Clinton's former Labor Secretary Robert Wright who said, we are adding jobs, we're adding lousy jobs, we're not adding jobs that are paying high wages. And so I think the president should be aware of the sentiments of the middle class and especially people in urban communities about the state of the economy. But this is about legacy. And I think tonight he should start to move the country in the direction to say, this is what my legacy is going to be, and this is what I hope that you remember me by, because he has to define it. He can't allow Republicans or Democrats, liberals or progressives to define his presidency. He should start to do that tonight.
Right, and what he has tried to do has been blocked every step of the way.
Well, he's so been successful on a lot of initiatives.
Oh, yeah, he has been, but he has not had this. So this is his time to lay out what direction we're trying to go in. Because sure. Roland is correct, is that people are not, all this talk about anger at Washington, there's a lot of anger at this black president. And there's a lot of discomfort with the fact that the country is changing as dramatically as it is. And so this is the time to move forward that we are going to have an inclusive, multiracial country. We're not going to quarantine Muslims. We're not going to round up Mexicans and ship them out. We're all going to be part of the American family. And he's in a position now with his platform and with not having to run again to be able to make those those kinds of arguments.
Well, first of all, you spoke about his legacy. One of the things that people are going to be dealing with also is going to be his legacy as it relates to his Department of Justice and also these various cases. In fact, like the Eric Garner case, there still has been no action by the Department of Justice against the officers who killed Eric Garner in 2014. But now in New York, they are taking action against Sergeant Kizzy Adonis, one of the two New York Police Department supervisors who was on the scene. She was served with departmental disciplinary charges for her role in the confrontation that led to the 2014 death of Eric Garner. Now, the question is, and this was interesting, this was a sergeant who said, "That's enough, let him up." But they still ignored her, yet she's the one who's being targeted and not the officer who actually killed Eric Garner. They're saying she had a failure to supervise. Well, Erica Garner, who is the daughter of Eric Garner, she has said this makes no sense, and she joins us right now via Skype from New York. Erica, welcome to News One Now.
Good morning.
What do you make of this? What do you make of this decision to go after this sergeant, but not the officer who actually choked to death your father?
I usually don't agree with Sergeant head of the police sergeant union out here in New York, Ed Mullins. I really don't find myself agreeing with him. But on this one, it is ridiculous. It's political driven. A lot of people think that I'm defending the cop, but actually, I'm just stating the obvious. If you could find evidence or enough evidence to incriminate this woman, a black woman, how come Daniel Pantaleo or the other officers, or even the sergeant that was there, the other sergeant, Delatorre, I know him very well because from my protests and seeing him, how come she was the only one targeted to get arrested after a year and a half? Like, it doesn't make no sense to me. I believe if you're going to charge her for failure to supervise, I think it goes all the way to the top. What about Bill Bratton and Bill de Blasio and the borough commander and Debbie Rose, the city councilwoman, the black city councilwoman? Is really more deeper than that, and I believe that the corruption and the injustice need to stop.
What do you also, I mean, first of all, one of the reasons why they took this action now, because of statute of limitations, it was 18 months, and so that was running out. But it sends a very different signal, I think, to say, well, we're going to target this one supervisor, this one sergeant, and still the officer who choked Eric Garner to death, the medical examiner ruled it a homicide. That officer still has a badge, still has a gun, is still getting paid, and no action has been taken against him.
Yeah, it's just crazy. If you look, it's happening all over the country. If you look at Sandra Bland's case or even the Freddie Gray case, they target the black officer. He wasn't the only one, the one who got arrested or brought up charges. He wasn't the only one there, but all his white counterparts wasn't even brought up on any charges, and they didn't even get a conviction. And then you have the black mayor. She's in trouble. Then you have people like Ram, Bill de Blasio. They need to resign because they are failure to supervise, protect, and serve us, and be leaders that we need.
I've got to ask you this as well. We were talking about the legacy of President Barack Obama. The Department of Justice, there's no decision in terms of whether they're going to file charges against this officer. You look at the case of Rekia Boyd, Ayanna Jones. I can go down the line. You have not seen the DOJ come forward charging anybody in any of these cases. Your assessment of the Department of Justice thus far?
Time is up. I spoke in a panel with the Civil Rights Liberty Union like last month, and it was representatives from the DOJ there, and I told them, time is up. What is the answer? Like, when are you going to give the Garner family an answer? The only answer was that they will give it to me soon. They've been telling my family for a year and a half that they still need time to investigate. But if they can come back with the police department can come back with a decision to come after this black woman, why not Daniel Pantaleo? He still got to face department charges or disciplinary charges, but outside the federal investigation. And what I keep hearing is we will release our information when the DOJ finish their investigation. It's a lot of back and forth and bouncing off. They waiting for this one, they waiting for that one. Time is up. We need answers now. And they assured me that they're looking at all officers involved in my dad's case, but it's just not enough. I want to put pressure on them. Like, a year and a half later, still no answers. And the only people who's been arrested in my dad's case is people of color. The other person who's been arrested and convicted have to keep on fighting is Ramsey Orr. I went to a court date for him to support him yesterday, and I got bum rushed by 15 officers because I had my phone out. And they caused, you know, they was very aggressive, and it gave me firsthand experience about the police brutality. Gotcha. And how they're so aggressive. I'm a female, and I had 15 men in my face, and I was scared to death. I was scared, but I wasn't willing to give up my phone or have them intimidate me. The officers on Staten Island, they know me from being out there.
Gotcha.
And you know, protesting and stuff, and it just needs to stop. And right. About this black woman, about this black woman, what was she supposed to do? Got all these big officers, men, piling on top of my father's back. She called for assistance, and like they didn't respect her authority, and that further shows.
All right. You know. Well, Erica Garner, we certainly appreciate you joining us, and we'll see. We certainly keep following the story to its conclusion. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Folks, we come back. Our headlines, including the mother who helped her teenage son escape to Mexico, you know, the affluenza case. How the hell she got bail? Really? Helped her rich little son escape? Okay, I'm going to deal with that when we come back. Also, black voters hold more power than ever in the upcoming election. We talked to Steve about his book. It says Brown is the New White in America. It is 17 before top of the after the hour. News 1 Now on TV 1.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number 2, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
Bill Cosby's lawyers have filed a petition requesting that the court dismiss all charges brought against him in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. Cosby's attorneys claim that the prosecutor has violated a 2005 agreement in which they said in part, quote, the Commonwealth agreed that Mr. Cosby would never be prosecuted with the respect to the allegations of sexual assault made by Andrea Constant. If the dismissal is not granted, Cosby's attorneys have also asked that the court disqualify District Attorney Kevin Steele from any further involvement in the case because of his violations of the agreement and ethical rules when using this case during his campaign. Of course, we'll keep you updated on this case as it develops. The Maryland Court of Special Appeals has postponed the trial of Cesar Goodson, one of the Baltimore police officers charged with the April 2000 death of Freddie Gray. The delay will persist until it has been decided whether or not fellow officer William Porter can be forced to testify in Goodson's trial. Last week, Baltimore Circuit Judge Barry Williams ruled Porter would have to testify, but the Court of Appeals blocked the ruling. Goodson, who was driving the van in which Freddie Gray was fatally injured, faces the most severe charges, second-degree murder. If convicted, he could spend up to 30 years in prison. Folks, charges are pending against four teenagers accused of raping an 18-year-old woman in New York. The attack happened on Thursday when the victim and her father were walking through a park. One of the teens took out a gun and ordered the father to leave. The men then allegedly took turns raping the woman. New York police released a video of the suspects in a bodega just moments before the incident. The teenagers range in age from 14 to 17. Two of the young men were turned in by their parents, while the other two were apprehended by cops. The fifth suspect remains at large. Folks, let's go to Texas, where we have an update on the case of the McKinney girl who was forcefully slammed to the ground by a cop there. Eric Case Boat's controversial actions at the neighborhood pool party was seen all across the country. Well, now the Texas Rangers, they have sent their investigation to the Collin County prosecutor. Now, remember, in June, Case Boat was caught on video pulling his gun on two black teenagers and manhandling a black 14-year-old girl, pinning her to the ground and pushing her head into the ground. Case Boat resigned shortly after the video surfaced. The Texas Rangers aren't commenting on the findings at this time, but they are passing it again this off to the Collin County DA for them to decide how they are going to proceed. That we'll certainly keep our focus on that as well. Folks, we also have this here, which is another interesting story that is taking place that we've sort of been covering as well here. And that is, folks, pull the next story up, please. Pull the next one up. Thank you. Detroit. Now, right now, kids in Detroit were not in class on Monday because there were so many teachers who were sick. They staged a sick out. The teachers are protesting their pay, school conditions, including rat and mouse infestations in overcrowded classrooms.
These teachers put this together because they are advocates. They're advocates for our students. I have teachers calling me every day. These teachers are in tears and they're crying. And they know our hands are tied by all of the laws that are, made against us. So they're saying, look, enough is enough. We have to do something. We have to advocate for our children. And whatever the consequences are, we're going to have to deal with it. But we have to stop bashing teachers. Teachers are in the classroom with students every day. Every day. And they're calling me and they're pushing me. And they're, Ivy, we got to do something. I've been talking to the district. I'm only one person. But you know what? We keep telling our members our union is only as strong as its members. Our members are speaking. Yes, and we need to start listening.
A debt-ridden district with 46,000 students has about $500 million in debt. Has been under state oversight for almost 7 years. State School Superintendent Brian Whiston has scheduled a meeting with the district emergency manager to discuss the safety and health concerns brought up by the teachers' union. No further information on when the teachers will come back to the classroom. You know, that's always a little rough when you talk about you have kids trying to go to school and then teachers stage a sick out.
Yeah. No, go ahead, Paris.
I think it's important that the teachers have their rights heard and can come to work in a clean, respectful environment. But at the same time, it's a delicate balance because we need them to teach the children. And having thousands of kids outside of school, especially in Detroit, is not always the best idea. So it's a very delicate balance.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's like you're saying, it's a darned if you do and darned if you don't situation. I understand the teachers are organized and they have these legitimate concerns. Just a one-day sick out doesn't seem like too much harm to make their point. On the other hand, you can imagine the problems that can be created when you have kids who are supposed to be in school who are somewhere else out there. Either they're at home or they're not at home. They're out. It's a problem. The state took over, Roland. And if the state took over, the state has got to get more involved in the funding problems associated with the district and the administration.
Right.
All right. Then when we come back, we're going to talk about the affluenza mom. Guess what, y'all? She out of jail. How in the hell did she get bail? Already a flight risk. But they lowered the bail from $1 million to $75,000. Also, the face of the new American majority is no longer blue-eyed and blonde. We'll talk with the author of a book that explains why brown is the new white. Also, how do you need to get your budget straight and get out of debt? We'll talk with an expert who is teaching black women how to save and how to invest. And they're actually having huge dividends. All of that next on News One Now TV.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin. Every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Tanya Couch, the mother of affluenza teen Ethan Couch, will be released from jail today. Couch posted bond yesterday after it was reduced from $1 million to $75,000 after her attorneys argued her bond was set too high. Since Couch has been behind bars, she's complained about her jail accommodations. Oh.
I explained to her that this was a jail, not a resort.
Okay, I'm confused. Now, Couch was charged with hindering the apprehension of a fugitive. Her son took him to Mexico, where he went to the strip club because he would violate his probation after video surfaced with alcohol present, which he was not supposed to have. Now, y'all remember, Ethan Couch became famous when he was driving drunk, killed four people, injured nine others in 2013. Now, he remains in Mexico fighting extradition to the United States. Let's go to our panel, Steve Phillips, Paris Denard, David Swirlick. How in the hell is this woman out of jail?
It's a double standard. You know, back when Ethan Couch was originally charged, sentenced, but with no jail time, my former colleague at The Root, Stephen Crockett, wrote a column where he basically said, you know, if Ethan Couch has affluenza, then black teenagers must have Negro beaties. Because there is a double standard in this case. Clearly, it is just almost impossible to imagine a black teenager or a black family getting this same level of kid glove treatment from the justice system.
But here's a mother who has already fled with her son.
Yeah.
Already. This is not like, okay, she was aware that he was going to leave the country. No, she took him with her. They were in possession of a gun.
Well, the question is, what is the cure for affluenza? It looks like it's reduced, yeah, you know, bail. It's getting off free and having your son go to Mexico after killing four people. Right. I mean, it was funny when he said, this is not a country club, it's jail. Well, luckily, you're still alive, because for people in our community, you go to jail and you don't have these luxuries. And so justice needs to be blind, but sometimes, in this case, you can see justice is not fair, and it has a direct correlation to how much money you have. And in this instance, it's wrong, and I think the people should stand up and say, enough is enough. This is preposterous.
Right. Yeah, there's no question. You can get the justice you can afford. And the mechanics of the justice system are designed to really control, not to provide justice regardless of how much money you have or what you look like.
Now, I'm reading this story that's in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. The judge, first of all, the Couch is required to live with her oldest son, Stephen McWilliams, who's in Tarrant County, check in weekly with the Tarrant County probation officer, wear the monitor, and abstain from drugs and alcohol. The judge is Judge Wayne Savant. Now, I got to ask you, now I know Wayne. Wayne is a black judge.
He'd be on.
So I need to understand, Wayne, I'm going to have to call you and Wayne's wife, tell me to answer the phone. I need to understand how, again, you lower the bail.
And how is that a deterrent? I mean, how does that send a signal to her or to anybody else that if you do things like this, this will be your, you have to stay at home with your son?
Yeah, no, of course, because to Roland's point, it's not like we don't know. She was already a flight risk by going with him to Mexico in violation of his parole. Right. To me, the issue is that, look, if the judge in this case has solid legal grounds for saying this bail is too much, or yes, this mom potentially committed a crime, but let's not, you know, throw her under the jail, so be it. But then let's treat all citizens that way. Let's not just treat citizens who can afford the best lawyers.
Well, and so here's the deal, folks. So what the lawyers claim was that, first of all, the father, Ethan Couch, said he ain't giving any money for her to have bail. That's not going to happen. Prosecutors call her a well-financed suspect. But Judge Salvant said it was clear. Folks, Shelley, go to my iPad, please. Judge Salvant said it was clear she could not post a bond on $1 million bail. It was set that high only to keep her in jail, which would be considered oppressive under the law. As the judge, I've got to look at the law, Salvant said. But again, though, please show me how you've already escaped once. I mean, this case to me has been shameful and dreadful all the way around. Mm-hmm. You cannot show me where a black or brown child could kill four people, and somehow avoid going to jail. There's a young man right now who folks are trying to get pardoned, who is also waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on the sentences given to juveniles, where he threw a punch at another student, and that student later died. That juvenile was given life in prison. Yeah. That juvenile, life in prison, yet this little punk killed four people.
And fled.
Injured nine, including paralyzing somebody from the waist down.
And fled. And so it's crazy. And when you look at these situations over and over again, I want to know, and I hope that Mothers Against Drug Drive and all these other type of organizations.
No. Well, first of all, Matt is targeting this. Matt is being submitting petitions saying they want his probation revoked and for him to go to jail for this action.
That's the type of public pressure that we need in these cases. Public pressure that we see that in black cases, when the public gets involved, young people, Black Lives Matter, we need the same public pressure from our side on this issue because it's not fair and it's not just.
Two Americas. As the current commissioner said, one black, one white.
Right.
Well, coming up next, folks, we're going to talk about this whole idea of how America is changing. This whole notion of America, you know, so is brown the new white? Really? Really, Steve? We'll talk about that next. Also, Budgetista has tips to boost your savings in the new year. Plus, Lawrence Fishburne dishes on turning his favorite book into a movie. It is 25 before top of the hour. News 1 Now on TV 1.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
There are more people of color in the United States than ever before, and that growth is expected to make a big difference in this year's election. In fact, we are moving even closer to becoming a majority-minority country. It is revolutionary. It is changing how we look at not only politics, but also corporate America, also sports, you name it. And so joining us right now, of course, Steve Phillips, he's been on our panel today. He's the author of a new book called Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority. And so, Steve, what's interesting about this is, and I always say this, you know, 30 years ago, all we heard was America will be a majority-minority country one day. People said, man, that's so doggone far away, we won't even be alive.
Right.
Well, then several things happened. White folks stopped having kids. Hispanics kept having kids. African-Americans kept having kids. And all of a sudden, that number began to drop. At first it was 2060, and then it was like 2055, then it was 2050, then it went down to 2047. What is it now?
Well, it's 2044 in terms of when the people of color will be the majority of the overall numbers in the country.
But right now, for the first time, 51% of all kids in public schools are black and brown.
Right, and for the past 4 years, the majority of babies being born are people of color. And yet what's left out of these analyses that look off into the future is that there has always been a consistent minority of whites who have sided with people of color. And so when you take that, which is in the range of 35% to 40%, and you add that to people of color, that is a new American majority that we have right now. And that's the majority that elected Obama and that reelected Obama and will be in play in 2016.
So with that said, how is it changing our politics? How is it changing our view even on economic policy, corporate America, if you will, as well?
Right. So so much of politics is focused around what will the swing voters, and usually it's the white swing voters, tolerate. Whereas we don't...
Yeah, black minority voters are never in that swing voter category.
No. It's clear where we are at. And so, but that also means that we can have a social justice public policy agenda by being able to deliver for the communities that have been historically marginalized and oppressed, and that building upon that, rather than having to worry about alienating and marginalizing those who have been in the swing voter categories, we can be much more bold, unapologetic, and forceful in putting forward our social justice agenda because we have the numbers now in order to win elections and keep winning.
But here's the question. Do we have the actual numbers, though? Do we have the vote? Do we have the overall numbers, or do we have the voting numbers? Because if you look at the fact in the last two election cycles, black women voted at a higher rate than anybody else.
Right.
The black voter trend was increasing even before President Barack Obama ran in 2008. But the problem is Latinos, significant numbers, but low voter numbers. You've got 2.1 million eligible but unregistered Latinos in Texas alone.
Right. Right. Yeah. People of color in Texas, and it's another million African Americans and Asians within Texas who are eligible but not voting. So we have the numbers to transform Texas. But if you look at the past 6 years, it's clear that when there's high voter turnout, 2008, 2012, we win. Obama lost 5 million white votes from 8 to 12, but he still actually won the election. But when people are not mobilized, not reached out to, and that's how we lost the House in 2010 and 2014.
Yeah, no, and I think Steve's thesis is on point, but the key is that if you have high voter turnout, which I think that right now that's a delicate ground for Democrats, because it's certainly in non-presidential years, right, you don't have that black and brown turnout in state, local elections, even statewide elections in many cases. You brought up Texas, right? You had Wendy Davis and I think it was Leticia Vanderput on the ballot there, and they were not successful, in part because Democrats, and I'm not just saying voters of color, Democrats in general, did not have a good showing in an off year.
Right, but we're not reaching out to them. And so in 2010 and 2014, we ran away from the Obama agenda, we ran away from the health care agenda, and we tried to pretend that we weren't actually pushing a social justice agenda. And then we also did not invest the kinds of resources. If we're going to be spending $1 billion in an election cycle, and almost half of the voters are people of color, half of the money should be going in towards organizing, mobilizing, reaching out to the voters of color as well.
And Steve, I think that's why you see so many people on both sides of the aisle trying to go after this, what they call the Obama coalition, trying to go after those voters, especially black and brown voters. And even on the Republican side, you see two Hispanics and one black person running for president. That shows the browning of America. But also, this is why a lot of people on the Republican side are saying, well, let's be careful in how we message about immigration. Let's be careful in how we message about these important issues, because we need to attract black and brown voters, because they know, we know on the Republican side, that we cannot win. I don't care what anybody says, we cannot win the White House if we do not have a significant amount of black and brown people coming over to vote for the Republican.
So I gotta ask y'all this here. So I was reading this story the other day by Patrick Healy and Jonathan Martin in the New York Times. Shelly, go ahead and pull up my iPad. The headline is, for Republicans, mounting fears of lasting split. So it's talking about Donald Trump. It's talking about his impact on the election. But there was a line in here that I want to talk about. And it said, the issues animating grassroots voters, opposition to immigration, worries about wages, and, quote, discomfort with America's fast-changing demographics.
And that's what's at stake in this election. In
But I want to talk about this, right, this phrasing of discomfort with America's fast-changing demographics. When you hear that, what does that mean to you? Discomfort.
That people are anxious, nervous, fearful about so
what
many
people. Here's my whole. That's precisely my whole point.
Right.
If we have to have an honest conversation, right, this is the New York Times talking to white voters, right, who are Republican.
Right. What's implied, right, in that, exactly, statement, to your point, Steve, is that there's at least a certain sector of the white electorate, of particularly in this case the white Republican electorate, that has the, as the article says, discomfort with the ascendant coalition, the ascendant majority. It's not all white voters, but clearly this is what that article,
right,
is addressing.
But even Democrats, yeah, are afraid.
No, right.
As
and
well.
Right. I think Democrats and Republicans have two different versions of a similar problem.
Right.
President Obama actually doesn't get credit for the fact that he did much better among white voters as a black presidential candidate than any Republican, McCain, Romney, et cetera, did among voters of color.
Right, sure.
So, you know, Democrats are doing better on that score, and Republicans, I think, are sort of, if certainly someone like Trump is actively alienating voters of color,
in terms of Democrats, they are also often afraid of alienating white voters, particularly the white swing voters.
Right.
So that's why they will mute their politics, water down what they actually care about, not push as hard for a social justice equality agenda, because they don't want to offend the white swing voters. My argument is that we don't have to worry about that anymore. We have enough progressive white voters to be able to move forward with our full agenda in a full-throated fashion.
So what do y'all make of this whole idea that, well, you know, and I love what the narrative is that with white millennials, oh, you know, these are folks who have grown up in a different world, a different America. They've grown up in the Obama world. They've grown up in the hip hop world. Yet when you look at data that shows that the significant number of people who believe that that discrimination against whites is as equal to that as blacks, when you look at the views of some of these same white millennials, they pretty much are mirroring, not the exact same, how their parents think. Paris, what are your thoughts?
Well, Roland, we were on the show, and remember that case with the fraternity down on the bus, and they were chanting and
yeah,
saying all this stuff.
In Oklahoma.
In Oklahoma. And that was the moment when I said, we're not where we think we are as a country.
Right.
Because these young men are millennials, they're educated, they're allegedly well-to-do, and yet they are harboring sentiments that we've heard 30, 40 years ago because they get it from their parents and their upbringing. And so the idea that we are this millennial culture is somehow more advanced or more accepting, it's not true. Now, there are some who might be, and we might be a little bit more open, but the remnants of racism and the remnants of prejudice and that discomfort is very real, and it's not going away because it's the fear of the unknown. And what you don't know, a lot of times they fear.
And we don't acknowledge the history of the country. We have the whole immigration debate without acknowledging that the very first immigration law from 1790, which existed until 1960s, said that the only way to be a citizen is to be a free white person. And that is the context for immigration within this country, is are we going to let white people only within the country? And so then we have this debate about illegals. Well, who were the first illegal people here? The Native Americans say everybody from Europe was an illegal. And so those types of arguments would change the debate, and so that the young people are not only getting arguments and only getting instruction that is from a more conservative standpoint.
Are you requiring people to actually read history, Steve? What is wrong with you?
I want to read accurate history.
Steve, I think the only danger in terms of, at least in messaging for the Democrats, right, you're clearly right on the numbers in terms of the coalition of black and brown and yellow and red voters, right? As long as Latino and Asian American voters vote 70%+ for Democrats, African Americans vote 80, 90, 95% for Democrats, you're right on the numbers. But I do think it would be a mistake in the next few cycles if Democrats give up on those persuadable, middle-of-the-road swing white voters, if only for two reasons. One, because we have such narrow margins in these elections, yeah. And for two, because it's not clear to me that people of color are voting Democrat because they're so progressive on issue by issue as much as it is that Republican strategists, apologies, are not doing really anything effectively to woo those people of color.
I don't think Steve was saying Dems should give up on those white voters. I think what he's saying is, which is real, is that if you are Democrats, you cannot play the game where you're tossing so much money at trying to procure those swing white voters, right, and you're ignoring the reality that if you don't drive your base hard, you're going to win. I mean, you can try to drive them as hard as you want to, but if they're not going to turn out, then you've lost. And then so now you really screwed yourself because now you got minority communities who are ticked off saying, we haven't seen you, you haven't shown up. And here's, I think, is going to be the real challenge that this White House, and I think it's going to be part of President Obama's legacy. And that is, in many ways, President Barack Obama, being an African-American, they ran the institutional structure, mm-hmm, that was in place politically, he didn't need.
Right.
The problem is that was dismantled in the last 7 years.
Right.
What is that now going to look like in the next election? And so, because I mean, I know for a fact his team pretty much like, look, we don't need the black county commissioners and the city councilmen, that whole black political infrastructure when it comes to running and getting the vote out. But what's going to happen when you have a non-African-American running?
Right, and that's what happened in 2014, which is why we lost in the North Carolina Senate race. The progressive side spent $20 million in negative television ads trying to influence the persuadables, who they thought were the persuadables, ineffectively. That same amount of money would have paid for 400 full-time staff going door-to-door and making phone calls.
Fair point.
And so this election, we're going to spend $1 billion. We should, and half of the Democratic voters are people of color, we should be spending $500 million targeting our community, hiring staff people, making the argument. And when you do that kind of work, you can increase turnout,
right,
even if Obama's not on the ticket.
The book, folks, is called Brown is the New White, How the Demographic Revolution Has Created a New American Majority by Steve Phillips. We sort of appreciate it. Thanks a bunch. Coming up, Tiffany the Budgetista, Alishay, She has a savings challenge to boost her income in the new year. Also, Lawrence Fishburne talks about bringing his passion project to the big screen. 10 before top of the hour, News 1 Now, TV 1.
Hi, I'm Teresa Griffin. I have a CD, and it's called Revival of Soul. And you are watching News 1 Now with Roland Martin on TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Well, the gap for African-American women is real. By the time black women retire, they have a poverty rate five times higher than that of white men and are half as likely to qualify for Social Security benefits as white women. Tiffany, the budgetnisha Alicia, started the Live Richer Challenge to help women save more. Last year, 20,000 women participated internationally. Collectively, they saved over $4 million, paid off more than $500,000 in debt, and one-third of participants opened a new savings account. Tiffany, the author of the book, Live Richer Challenge, Learn How to Budget, Save, and Get Out of Debt, Improve Your Credit, and Invest in 22 Days. She and I chatted yesterday about how she came up with the idea.
Well, it originated from my company, The Budgetnista. I started it really to help women get on track financially. And what I found was, so I would teach in person, and then I would post via social media, like finish teaching at the United Way or Prudential. And then women around the country started reaching out to me, asking me for more help. And so I thought, well, how can I take what I was doing in the classroom, how do I take that and share it virtually? And so the Live Richer Challenge was born.
What did you find to be the most consistent thing these women were not doing?
They were not saving. And as a result of not saving, what that really meant was they were not budgeting. They were not doing the basic money management things that you should have learned at home or at school. They were not doing those things.
So was it because they believe that, oh, I don't have any money to save, so therefore I can't do it, until you went through the process and said, no, actually, you do have money to save?
Well, it was really because they didn't know how to budget. There was just a lack of basic knowledge. What I find is women are really eager to learn. They just didn't know where to start. They were afraid. They had never been taught anything else outside of what was taught at home, which was kind of like the scarcity mindset. And so I wanted to switch all of that around and show them that, one, you likely do have enough. Two, budgeting is not hard. And three, there is a community and a collective that will help you do so.
And you talked about these various financial challenges, and we talked about, of course, struggling to save, but also the whole idea of living paycheck to paycheck.
Yes. So paycheck to paycheck is something that the typical American, unfortunately, is living with. And what I wanted to teach the women that that, too, is just a basic financial issue. It starts with the budget. My father would say all roads lead to Rome. I don't know if you've ever heard that saying. Mm-hmm. Right? And so all financial roads really lead to your budget. It's just the basic principle of you have to list everything you spend money on, how much it costs you a month, and how much you're spending a month versus how much you're saving a month or how much you're making a month. Mm-hmm. And that's a basic budget. And so once I taught the women that, they were up and running.
Poor credit score.
Yes. Credit score is probably the number two thing that women were asking for. But credit scores, the reason why people have poor credit scores is because they don't understand the components of a credit score. They think a credit score is just, well, I pay my bills on time, but there are other things that go into it. How long is your credit history? Do you have any inquiries, meaning how many credit cards have you opened in the last year or so? How much is your utilization rate? A utilization rate is just this. How much of your credit limit are you utilizing? Most people don't realize that anything over 30%, you are bringing down your score. So if you don't know the rules to the game, you're always going to lose the game. And that's what I found.
It is a game.
Yes.
It is designed to screw you to pay higher interest rates.
No, definitely. And so, for example, a woman told me the other day, well, the credit card company told me that if I pay off my credit card in full every month, it's not good. That should leave at least a little bit on. I'm like, of course they're going to tell you that because they want you to pay interest. So that's another game that credit card companies are playing, and they're not really being truthful. So really, to me, I feel like it's my job to teach the rules of the game so we can win too.
Okay, let's talk about top financial goals.
Yes.
That many of these women said they wanted to have.
So definitely a higher credit score. They wanted to save a little bit more. Women wanted to learn how to budget. They want to get out of debt, including especially student loan debt. A lot of women especially want to travel. So a lot of these things, to me, it's more than money. I say it's more than money, it's mm-hmm. a movement. So all of these things, money is merely a tool for a better life. And so these things that women are struggling with is because they're seeing that money is affecting the quality of living that they now don't enjoy.
But one of the things I still think that jumps out for a lot of folks that we also have to deal with as African Americans is that when you begin to reach a certain level economically, you are in essence also helping other family members and other people.
Yes.
That also prevents us from being able to build and create wealth.
Yes, there's a Prudential has a study called the African American Experience Study, and what they found was that the typical African American person living now lives in the sandwich generation. They're looking after their children, but they're also looking after their parents and grandparents. And so you're struggling because oftentimes we're the ones that made it, you know, the ones who are in our age range. And so they're struggling with, well, how do I take care of my kids and also take care of my grandparents?
And also help a brother or a sister, or
exactly,
help a cousin out. I mean, you start looking up. I mean, that $100, $200, $300 begins to add up,
exactly,
over a period of months and years.
So this is what I typically do, and this is what I realized why my father taught me. So I have four sisters. So he and my mom have five girls. So what he did was he understood that if I want to keep you out of my pocket, then I have to teach you how to manage your own pocket. And so I think that if I can teach women, not just women, but men as well, how to manage their money, and I try to teach it in such a way that they can take that information, mm-hmm, and show other people, that's really why I created the challenge. We're up to 60,000 people now in 80 different countries.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, how do folks reach out to you?
So if they want to reach out to me, they can find me as The Budget Nista all over social media and TheBudgetNista.com.
You also have LiveRicherChallenge.net?
Yes, that's if people want to sign up for the challenge. It's absolutely free. It's my give back to my community, and it's one of the ways that I want to change and shift the conversation that African Americans are having about personal finance.
And one of the things you say is take small steps, which, you know, for a lot, I mean, I don't care what it is. I mean, that's where you start.
Yes, always. Many drops of water does a mighty river make. So I'm Nigerian, and so we speak in parables and stories, and so every little bit counts. So definitely small steps are critical.
So again, LiveRicherChallenge.net.
Yes, to
sign up. And what else?
And you can find me as The Budget Nista and at TheBudgetNista.com.
Okay, all right. We surely appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
All right, folks, we're going to have a Lawrence Fishburne package for you tomorrow. And you know how Black people are. You know how Black people are.
Our people.
So, Charlotte Prince, who is a morning producer, sends me a text. Say happy birthday, Coach Prince, my daddy. See, Black people do that. Right. You know, Black people will text you and ask for a shout out.
Right.
So, Shauna's daddy, happy birthday.
Right.
Your daughter got it in. So, but don't be texting me a shout out.
Right.
I mean, I meet folks around the country. They say, dog, give me a shout out on TV. No! All right. Appreciate y'all. Thanks a bunch. Holla!
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.